The American military's full withdrawal from Afghanistan, its chaos, and its backlash. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Wednesday, August 18th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, a humanitarian crisis escalates, and so does the political pressure on President Biden. We talk with political scientists Lisa Hager and Dave Wiltsy about the fallout as it unfolds. Could the problem with zebra mussels impact your family budget? SDPB's Laura Johnson has that story. Then we meet an author whose love for history and romance merge in a new novel, plus the multi-layered ways of seeing the world with artist Martin Weinstein. That's coming later in the hour. We're broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first.
With South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Laura Johnson. The Taliban is now occupying the capital city of Afghanistan after the U.S. removed its troops. A South Dakotan who served in Afghanistan is criticizing the U.S. withdrawal, but he's also proud of his service. SDPB's Kyle Ireland has more.
Retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Ben Jones is the state historian. He served in Afghanistan twice, once as an advisor, and later as a member of the group responsible for the transition out of the country. He says the full-scale exit may be counter to U.S. interests.
I would think that some other path to a lessening of the presence while maintaining something there to support the Afghan National Army in its fight against the Taliban would have been preference, in my opinion.
President Joe Biden said in a speech that he stands by his decision to pull out of Afghanistan. He said American troops shouldn't die in a war that Afghan forces won't fight for themselves. Jones is disappointed by those remarks.
The accusation that the ANA won't fight over the past several years is just wrong. The question is, why did they give up in the last several weeks? I don't know the answer to that.
Jones says the U.S. withdrawal leaves many veterans wondering why they were there and what they accomplished. He says the time and effort weren't wasted.
You know, for 20 years, we showed them, the Afghan people, what the possibilities were. And I think that's something we can be proud of. And we also, the United States and the coalition, prevented an attack like 9/11 from happening again. It's hard to prove the negative, but we can also take some comfort in that.
The Taliban has captured all major Afghanistan cities while the U.S. scrambles to evacuate American citizens and allies. I'm SDPB's Kyle Ireland.
South Dakota kindergarten classrooms may see more students this fall. That's because many parents kept their children home during the pandemic. SDPB's Jenna Scott has more.
Early childhood and pre-K programs are often a good indicator of how many kindergarten students a school district can prepare for. But many South Dakota families don't have access to such programs, and that leaves schools in the dark. Head Start is one of the programs that prepares young children for school. Carmen Stewart directs the Head Start program at USD.
So we have some numbers regarding how many children are enrolled in Head Start, but there are so many children that stay at home or receive service in unregulated preschool or unregulated childcare that it is really hard to get any solid numbers as a state.
That leaves teachers unsure about how many students to prepare for. Some students receive ample preparation for kindergarten at home, while others receive little support.
A kindergarten teacher, that first day of school and that first year, they're really challenged because they may have children in a two-year age spread with lots of different early childhood experiences coming into their door.
Stewart says Head Start helps transition students into school. She says the program also helps parents understand their child's developmental abilities and the best options that are available for their education. I'm SDPB's Jenna Scott.
Police in Rapid City are working to identify a person of interest in a homicide investigation. Authorities have already made one arrest in the fatal shooting of 20-year-old Austin Freeman last Friday. Investigators say they are also looking for women in connection with the case. Police Captain James Johns says it appears Freeman was in the wrong place at the wrong time. For SDPB, I'm Laura Johnson.
And I'm Lori Walsh. As the humanitarian crisis continues to unfold in Afghanistan, President Biden is facing increasing bipartisan backlash for how the full withdrawal of the U.S. military has been handled. Tim Shorn is the Director of International Studies and Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of South Dakota. He joins us now from SDPB studios at USD with some key takeaways from the situation as it continues to unfold. Dr. Shorn, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So once again, the world is watching the humanitarian impacts of U.S. policy. Even so, most Americans still don't want the U.S. military to actually be on the ground in Afghanistan long term. Let's start with you. What are some of the important things that you think people need to remember during this crisis right now?
Well, I would argue that it was never going to end any other way. The Taliban were never completely removed from Afghanistan. They have always been clawing back since we initially removed the Taliban government. On top of that, we have seen a significant amount of corruption within the Afghan government that we helped to create, and also a real lack of dedication on the part of many Afghans, including those who were serving in the Afghan National Army. And so I think when you put together those three points, it's really hard to see this ending any different way.
Lack of dedication from those. President Biden definitely spoke strongly about that in his address to the nation earlier in the week. Help us understand that more, because it sounds like a really critical thing to say. What are we talking about there?
Well, and it comes from a number of different directions. First, you have a number of young Afghan men who were looking for a paying job, and this was such an opportunity. But at the same time, they didn't necessarily want to put their lives on the line fighting the Taliban. And that could have been because they had other responsibilities at home. It could have been because they had some sympathy with the Taliban. And it could have been because they knew the Taliban would be around for a long time while the U.S. and our allies would not be. And so there was a real concern that, desertions were creeping upward. Also, you had a significant amount of corruption within the Afghan National Army. You had officers and others who were responsible for the troops in the army siphoning off funds, keeping money, perhaps selling equipment. And so it was going to be a very, very high hill to climb to make the Afghan National Army a force that could hold its own against the Taliban.
So what are we watching for in the days ahead regarding refugees and retaliation from the Taliban, who are now in charge of really every aspect of the Afghanistan government?
I doubt that there will be many refugees who are allowed to leave for a couple of reasons. First, the Taliban may not allow them to leave, and second, a lot of countries are hesitant, including the United States, to take too many Afghan refugees. We're already seeing commentators and members of Congress saying that we shouldn't allow in Afghan refugees without a full vetting process. Well, as that occurs, if they're stuck in Afghanistan, it's going to be too late. And also, we're going to see the Taliban solidifying their control over the government. They are apparently asking civil servants to return to work and to continue doing their jobs. At the same time, there are reports that there are long assassination lists targeting those who worked with the United States and our allies, those who served in the government, and perhaps even those with too much of a Western influence in their lives. And so we're going to see a solidifying of the control of the government by the Taliban. At the same time, we're going to see significant violence, despite some of the words to the contrary. That doesn't, the positive feelings don't always trickle down to the lowest level. And so we're going to see people who are opposed to the Taliban protesting, but chances are, as we've already seen, we're going to see an increased violent response on the part of the Taliban against those who oppose them.
The Taliban has been known for providing cover for al-Qaeda. You and I have talked before about the situation in Syria and the kind of vacuum that it creates when the U.S. leaves behind, no footprint. What is the U.S.'s interest in Afghanistan and what's happening there with the Taliban government?
Well, Al-Qaeda has had a continuing presence over the last decade or two as well. And the question becomes, how much of a footprint are they able to establish, and how much freedom of movement does the Taliban grant them this time? So I think the United States is going to be very concerned about a rise of Al-Qaeda again. Now, whether or not Al-Qaeda's focus will be on the near enemy in the region or the far enemy, us again, remains to be seen. At the same time, we also see ISIS inserting itself into Afghanistan. They have been doing so for a couple of years, but the Taliban have been opposed to the presence of ISIS, and it has devolved into violence between the two groups at times. And so we're going to have to see, will there be some type of kind of marriage of convenience, or in fact, will there continue to be a struggle between those to Islamist forces, the Taliban and ISIS?
Are we going to know? I mean, what are we going to know publicly when, you know, you have obviously journalism collapsing there as well? We're not going to get the same kind of reports from this area that we might have gotten in the years past. What do you think we'll know, and what will be a mystery?
That's a good question. You know, some of the stuff is still going to play out on, you know, live news broadcasts for the probably next week or so. But we've already seen journalists being targeted, both domestic and foreign journalists. And we're going to have to, at some point, probably depend on eyewitness accounts from those refugees who do escape into Pakistan or Uzbekistan or elsewhere. But it's going to be increasingly difficult to know for sure what is going on. The Taliban weren't known for being particular media friendly prior to 2001, and I doubt that in the near future they're going to prove particularly media friendly again. They have been playing to a wider audience over the last week, but I would expect that to come to an end soon.
Tim Shorn is Director of International Studies and Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of South Dakota. Thanks, Tim, for helping us again with context. We'll talk to you next time.
Sounds good. Thank you.
We'll talk more about the situation in Afghanistan on today's Dakota Political Junkies conversation. But first, the zebra mussel infestation in South Dakota waterways continues. Laura Johnson has that update. You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
The Taliban may be promising that women can return to work and participate in government, but the reality on the ground is more complicated.
The stronger the Taliban got, the stronger the threats got.
Why one Afghan gynecologist fled her country, and the future of women in Afghanistan. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain on SDPB.
Program funding provided by First Dakota National Bank, supporting the businesses and individuals with a dream and the passion and drive to make it a reality. What will be your South Dakota first? More at firstdakota.com/first.
Hawaii's tourist industry has had a busy, busy summer.
Minimal staff, minimal capacity, minimal inventory, and yet we were blowing our sales records out of the water.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Things in the islands, though, can take a swift turn, you know. We'll tell you more next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6:30 Central, 5:30 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Program funding with your support and by Ingalls Homestead, Laura's Living Prairie. Sharing Laura Ingalls Wilder's pioneer heritage through covered wagon rides and hands-on activities. Online at IngallsHomestead.com.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. This summer, there are new efforts to prevent and limit damage to the dams along the Missouri River. Invasive zebra mussels are clogging hydroelectric systems, and that could increase rates for customers. SDPB's Laura Johnson has this story.
There's a growing infestation of zebra mussels on the Missouri reservoirs. Gary Hinkle is Deputy Chief of Operations in Omaha for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. He says Gavin's Point Dam in Yankton County has been hit the hardest so far.
For the summer of 2020, Gavin's had to have each of the three units shut down at three different times to clear the zebra mussels from the cooling water piping. A typical Gavin's Point outage for a week could be up to $50,000 in lost revenue.
Hinkle says that loss of revenue could raise utility prices for customers of the Western Area Power Administration.
People that benefit from the power that we produce actually have an arrangement where they will provide the government upfront funding for important projects, usually capital improvement projects.
Hinkle says prices have not risen yet because of zebra mussels. Gavin's Point Dam is the only one on the reservoir that's needed maintenance so far, but the Army Corps is using other methods to prevent the zebra mussels from spreading. Russell Kiefer is Operation Projects Manager at Fort Randall Dam, just upstream from Gavin's Point. He says zebra mussels attach to the inside of pipes, clogging the cooling devices needed for generating units.
You're probably talking a good month to remove all the air coolers and clean them out and so forth. So that's a lot of revenue loss. It'd be millions in lost revenue just for an outage to take care of something and that can be easily treated for, $25,000-$30,000 a year using EarthTech QZ chemical in an injection system.
Kiefer says his team is getting ahead of the problem. Fort Randall will inject a diluted copper ion solution into the cooling system of the dam later this summer. It will knock zebra mussel colonies out of the piping. Kiefer says even further upstream at the Big Bend Dam, they're using a copper generator that works similarly to the copper ion solution. Both facilities had to get pesticide permits to use copper in their cooling system. That's because the copper eventually makes its way downstream. John Hargrave is a water quality specialist for the Army Corps Omaha District.
It will be massively diluted because of just the volumes that they have going through their upstream and downstream. And it's what we saw at Big Bend is just the volumes going through there will dilute it to a level that's below the detection limit at our laboratory.
Hargrave says the Corps will continue to watch levels of copper concentration. Zebra mussels are native to Eurasia, but hitchhiked in the ballast tanks of ocean-going ships. They were first discovered in the Great Lakes in 1988. Since then, the mussels have lake-hopped to other waterways across the U.S. Tiny zebra mussels are called villagers. UV light systems can destroy them, a technique the Corps is trying in some locations. Nick Harrington is communications manager for the State Game, Fish, and Parks Department. He says boaters can help prevent the spread of mussels.
They're microscopic, and there can be, in a 5-gallon bucket, you look in, it looks like it's empty. It's not. I mean, in that 5-gallon bucket, we could have 900 villagers in there. And if that gets moved to a different water body, that's how these zebra mussels spread.
Harrington says that's the reason for a state law that makes people take their boat plugs out when moving from one body of water to another. Reporting for SDPB, I'm Laura Johnson.
You can find and share this story on our website, sdpb.org/news. Ahead on the program, political scientists Lisa Hager and Dave Wiltsy join us for our weekly Dakota Political Junkie segment. We'll talk about the federal policy in Afghanistan. You're on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Robin Young. Is there still bias in the process of granting interviews to job applicants? Economists sent 83,000 fake applications to more than 100 companies to find out.
Applications with distinctively black names were called back about 10% less often than their white counterparts.
Name bias. Next time, here and now.
this afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, Noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by the South Dakota Hall of Fame, congratulating 2020 inductee Glenna Foberg of Aberdeen, an innovative educator dedicated to helping students on the margins. More about Glenna Foberg at sdhalloffame.org.
Join your friends and neighbors by keeping SDPB strong. Become a $10 a month sustaining member and gain access to SDPB Passport. It's an on-demand library of hundreds of PBS and South Dakota Public Broadcasting shows, your favorites on your time. Details at sdpb.org/passport.
Program funding is provided by Acupuncture for Health, gentle, complementary care for acute and chronic conditions. Clinics in Rapid City and Custer. Acupuncture for Health, serving the Black Hills since 2003.
Politics and Public Policy Reporting is supported by the Center for Western Studies at Augustana University.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Focus on President Biden's domestic agenda has been eclipsed by the withdrawal of the U.S. military from Afghanistan. The world has watched Afghans clinging to the outside of U.S. cargo planes as those planes try to depart the airfield. Many have seen images of hundreds of people crammed inside those planes. The president addressed the nation earlier this week and took a measure of responsibility for the chaos of the transition, but he also pointed out he was the fourth U.S. president with his fingerprints on this particular international policy. Today, we're welcoming political scientists David Wiltsey and Lisa Hager from South Dakota State University with some key takeaways. Dr. Wiltsey, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Hager, thank you as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We're going to start our time together with a little audio clip for further perspective. This is Afghan journalist Zubair Babakar Chail talking with NPR's Morning Edition about the emotional toll of the Taliban takeover and fears for what happens next, including for Afghan journalists.
To be honest, I was emotional a few times, sometimes watching the Taliban fighters using American-provided Humvees and vehicles to the Afghan government that they were using. So I was so sad, and I spent these days panicking, and the last 4 days, for me, it seems like a very long time.
So these are not the images, the voices, what a U.S. president wants people to see and hear. This is not what President Biden wanted to happen. Was he too optimistic, though, in his prediction of how this transition might unfold? Dave, let's start with you.
Well, I didn't really see much optimism in his speech or his reaction here.
Before he thought that it would unfold before it did.
Yeah, I think it's pretty clear that our entire national security establishment either just completely misread the instability and the fragility of the Afghan state, or they weren't broadcasting that back to anyone outside of certain circles. But the president was put in an almost impossible position here. If you want to leave a quagmire, how do you go about doing it effectively? And it's very difficult to navigate. There's a lot of pressures that they're feeling politically. But in the end, it is, it's almost an impossible position for someone to be in. It's far easier to do what his two predecessors did and just kind of string along the conflict, for decades than to, make this kind of withdrawal.
Lisa, anything you want to add to that thought? And then I want to talk a little bit about how this impacts, the domestic policy and some of the things that we're thinking about here at home. But anything you want to add to this idea of how a president navigates this kind of complexity?
Yeah, I would largely agree with what Dave said. There really isn't a great way to get out of Afghanistan when that is the plan that the Biden administration wanted to take. It's either continue to string out this conflict and the U.S. presence there or remove yourself. And, honestly, it just doesn't seem like there would be a great way in order to do this. There obviously could have been some better plans put in place, but it still likely would have been messy.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to a lot of commentators that the intel on how this was going to unfold was very good, which is also a red flag as far as what kind of intel we had to begin with. I want to pivot a little bit and talk about what this means domestically for a president who is still fighting a virus and, you know, national debt and an economy in peril, trying to come back post-pandemic. How does this impact really how he's seen in Congress, how he's seen at home? Lisa, we'll start with you there.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of interesting. For once here, we're having the focus be on something other than the COVID-19 pandemic. And so that does complicate things. Right now, we're seeing the Delta variant really take hold across the country. Lots of uncertainty regarding the start of the school year, both at the K-12 level, but also at universities. But right now, we're, you know, really seeing the focus turn to Afghanistan. So I think President Biden and his administration is going to have to start finding a way to balance the foreign policy side of the presidency with the domestic side of the presidency, which is tough. I mean, most of the time we see the president really dominating in that foreign policy realm. He's currently being criticized there, and we typically see Congress taking more of the reins with respect to domestic policy. So I see it being difficult for the Biden administration to have much control over domestic policy going forward.
Dave, further thoughts on that, especially as people kind of use this as an opportunity, a political opportunity, to point out or question the president's competency? After the Trump administration, one of the things that he ran on was his ability to enact policy in a measured and effective way. And some of his political opponents are now pointing out, not so fast, this is complicated stuff. Your thought on that? Just a political mudslinging?
Yeah, we don't have a lot of examples to draw on from history here to, you know, make a direct comparison or to get a feel for how much this can harm somebody, a president on the domestic side of politics. My suspicion is that it's not going to harm him too terribly in the long run. Certainly by the time the 2024 election comes along, I think this will be pretty much a faded memory. You'd be really hard pressed. You know, the closest analogy to this is the fall of Saigon. You'd be really hard pressed to say that the fall of Saigon was what led to Gerald Ford's domestic political troubles. When it comes to the effects that international affairs has on presidential popularity, I really think those are pretty limited to when we have very high casualties and conflicts that are just seemingly out of control. In the end, I just don't see this being as as a real doomsday scenario for the president politically.
So I am super curious because we've talked about different things and how long people, voters or the electorate, will remember them. And I don't come from a political science background. And what I hear you saying, Dave and Lisa, consistently is like the memory is not as long as you think it is, Lori. Is that true? Like, how quickly do people move on from, you know, political events, big news stories, and just say, yeah, that's not relevant to what happens next? You must know much about this that I do not know. Dave, you start.
Well, I mean, you look at the shift in the punditry on the right from a full-throated support of the withdrawal that President Trump was advocating, which was actually faster than what Biden did, to, you know, almost a 180-degree turnaround to instant criticism. This is something that, again, we're going to fall back onto our partisan cues for. Mm. And in the end, I just don't see this as having a huge effect on Biden's political base, the voters that are going to send him back to office, as domestic policies might, and any kind of domestic problems that might crop up between now and the election.
Interesting. Lisa, we fall back on our partisan cues. What are some of those, and how quickly do they evolve?
Oh, I mean, I agree that this is not probably going to have any sort of real impact moving forward as far as a possible Biden reelection or even the Democrats' chance of retaining the White House if by chance we do not see Biden choosing to run for reelection. The partisan cues are very strong. I mean, we are going to see people really falling along party lines with respect to this. Like Dave mentioned, you know, the Republicans really made an abrupt change with their views regarding the withdrawal from Afghanistan. Granted, I do think much of them were criticizing the approach that the Biden administration took and the aftermath in light of that we all saw on the media. But I think just moving forward, partisan cues are generally what is going to determine how people are choosing to vote when we do see key elections coming up.
So interesting. All right, speaking of some of that, let's talk about the fact that the census data has started rolling out for the nation nationwide. We're seeing a changing nation in South Dakota. We talked to the state demographer yesterday, and you know, that move to cities that we all know is happening intuitively is well documented. Our cities are getting bigger. They're going to have slightly more influence in their political power in peer and places like that. Dr. Wilsey, tell me a little bit about when census data comes out, imperfect though it is because of the pandemic year. We don't have overcounts or undercounts yet to sort of refer things to. What are some of your key takeaways from that data dump so far?
Well, you know, like you said, one of the big suspicions that people have is, you know, just what that urban migration is going to do to representation and, you know, just the character of representation and ultimately maybe a partisan effect as well. Here in South Dakota, I don't think it's going to have that much of an impact, largely because we don't see a real stark difference between the urban areas of the state and the rural areas of the state when it comes to partisan identification. So I don't think we're going to see much shifting around in terms of legislative majority sizes. I mean, we're just talking about degrees of how many Republicans are going to be elected. And in the end, I don't think it's going to affect the quality of representation all that much either, because South Dakota still is a rather rural state. And even though it is becoming more and more urbanized, people in those urban areas still have, you know, very tangible links to the rural areas. They do have a lot of connections to those areas as well. And I suspect that their representatives in peer will as well.
Yeah. Lisa, anything you want to add to this release of initial census data and, you know, how it changes, you know, politics in the state of South Dakota, if at all?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so for me, looking at it, I was obviously, of course, interested in how apportionment changed with respect to legislative districts for the U.S. House, but also some of the things we've seen coming out recently with just kind of the percentage of white Americans decreasing in America, becoming much more diverse, which I think will be interesting in terms of increasing the representation of Congress, because I frequently, you know, show my students what that looks like, and they're always really shocked with how it doesn't really align with what the population looks like as a whole. So it'll be interesting to see if there's even more women and more people of color being elected to federal office. I would largely echo what Dave said with respect to changes in South Dakota with that migration more to cities. I do think that people are going to retain their connection to a rural area and that their political opinions were, you know, primarily formed earlier on in their life. And so even though they are moving to a more urban area, they're still going to largely keep those same political attitudes.
All right, Dr. Hager, you mentioned back to school, and I was just looking at some back to college stuff last night for my daughter, and oh, the headache started pretty soon. Well, because we're traveling, you know, through states, and now all of a sudden I have to think about things that I didn't necessarily think about before, and sentinel testing, and I think gateway testing when they get there. Back to school is a tough transition. Is it different than last year, Lisa? Is it the same? Are people just fatigued of of thinking and talking about it, or is the anxiety heightening? Like, what do you want to say about back to school at this point? What are you seeing?
I think at this point, it's pretty interesting. I think there's just so much uncertainty in light of the COVID-19 pandemic and the Delta variant. We just don't really know what's going to happen. School districts, colleges, and universities are doing their best to make policies that they think will, you know, both be useful in terms of trying to mitigate the effects of the pandemic, but also ensure that we can get back to normal as much as possible. But then are we going to have to possibly, you know, pivot to online environments or more social distancing? Like, we just really haven't been able to see what's going to happen with respect to the Delta variant. So I think there's just a lot of uncertainty and anxiety moving forward about, you know, will we be able to kind of stick with what the plan is from day one, you know, going into December or even in the spring?
Lisa, someone's going to throw an object at my head when I say this, but we could move into another election with some of the same challenges that we thought were maybe going to be gone, and having the same conversations about mail-in ballots. And that's not beyond the stretch of possibility, is it?
No, definitely not. And I think one of the things that we were seeing with the use of mail-in ballots is that in certain situations, obviously it was very complicated, but there are states that have been completing mail-in elections for years, that I think it does open up the possibility of making voting easier and increasing turnout. Generally, we haven't seen a long-term increase in voter turnout with the transition to mail-in ballots. But, you know, I think it's something that's hopeful, but I think, you know, a lot of work needs to be done both in terms of, you know, how states are going to do this and increasing public confidence in mail-in voting.
Take a deep breath. We are not done with this pandemic. Lisa Hager is Assistant Professor of Political Science at SDSU. Dave Wiltsy is Associate Professor of Political Science, also at South Dakota State University. They both joined us on the phone. Lisa, thanks so much. See you next time.
Yep, for sure.
David, thank you as well.
Thank you.
Let's take a moment now to honor inductees into the South Dakota Hall of Fame. The enshrinement ceremony for the class of 2020 is September 10th and 11th. Katherine Kinsman, otherwise known as Kitty, served as the Secretary of Health for South Dakota. She served during both the Janklow and Mickelson administrations. She's known for her strength in leadership and her ability to unite others to get things done. We visited with her on In the Moment, August 12th, 2020.
I seem to have landed in places that have given me opportunities, not always where women have been prevalent. So, I consider that to be one of the things that I lucked out in life. When I came to the health department, we basically created the first coalition and began a more concerted effort. By the end of that time, we weren't successful getting hospitals and other places smoke-free, which is pretty amazing when you think about it. But we were able to get Governor Mickelson to sign an executive order requiring all state buildings and state vehicles to be smoke-free. So that was a big first step. Governor Mickelson's leadership style was quite different. He was much more hands-off on a lot of activities, and that was really an opportunity during my career to grow, having completed the time with Governor Janklow and organize projects and bring people together and do some things, obviously with his blessing, but an opportunity to kind of spread my wings, if you will. I've been involved in working to improve rural access to healthcare providers with the nursing profession. I was appointed by Governor Noem to serve on the women's delegation celebrating the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, and it's actually been quite an experience. Finding something that you're passionate about helps a lot, and then doing the best that you can with the talents and resources that you have is really all you can ask of somebody. And everyone in any of the teams that I've worked with over the years that does that, I think feels like they have put in work that can be excellent.
More in the Moment is ahead on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
On the next Fresh Air, writer Eyal Press talks about people working in jobs most of us would never want to do because they're difficult and punishing and in some way morally compromised. He interviewed prison mental health workers and correctional officers, oil rig workers, slaughterhouse employees, and military drone operators. His new book is Dirty Work. Join us.
This afternoon at 2, 1 Mountain on SDPB.
Over the past year or so, we've learned to expect the unexpected. Stories change, news breaks, and then breaks again. We'll be feeling the changes for years to come and in ways we can't yet imagine. NPR is here to keep you connected and informed, to be a vital resource in a changing world. Ask your smart speaker to play NPR or this station by name.
Ask your smart speaker to play SDPB.
As a business leader, you understand the importance of customer loyalty. SDPB listeners, our customers, trust us to inform and entertain, and 80% of them consider SDPB personally important. Your business brand is strengthened when it's heard here on SDPB Radio. 70% of our listeners prefer to do business with companies that support us. It's easy to get started. Send an email to underwrite@sdpb.org and let's talk.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. Pamela Novak is an author of historical fiction. Her latest novel, Never Let Go, follows the lives of five women who left their settlement at Lake Chetek in Minnesota during the Dakota conflict of 1862. She's speaking about her book tonight at the South Dakota Cultural Heritage Center in Pierre. She'll also appear Thursday night at the Fort Sisseton State Park. And later this month, Novak will have two presentations in Sioux Falls, at the Old Courthouse Museum and at Siouxland Libraries. Pamela Novak, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Lori. I appreciate the invitation.
You bring so much of your personal life and your personal interest into your work as a writer. Let's talk a little bit about that, as you know, you've done. Tell me where your love of history came from and how that intersected with your love of writing.
Well, history always fascinated me, even as a child. And Laura Ingalls Wilder was my big favorite author when I was a kid. And then when I was 11, I moved to Tracy, Minnesota, which is just about 6 miles from where Lake Chetek settlement was. And I had the good fortune to be friends with a girl whose father was a history teacher, and he also was a summer naturalist out at the Lake Chetek State Park. So he took us out there, and he showed us all the cabin sites. And then I later had him in school, and he fostered my love of history. Mm. So I was going to be a teacher, but always had stories in the back of my mind. And this was one that just haunted me, and I couldn't give it up. And eventually, I had to put it down on paper.
Yeah. Why these five women? This is based on a true story. Tell us a little bit about the plot of your book, Never Let Go. Yeah.
Lake Chetek was a very isolated settlement. And in 1862, during the U.S. Dakota War, it was attacked by a group of Sisseton Dakota. And these five women were taken captive. And the story just got to me because I read so many stories about the facts themselves.
Yeah.
And I read the sensationalized versions.
Right.
And I read the materials that were left. And I thought, you know, these five women had backstories, and something made them strong enough to survive this ordeal, and that's what I had to write about.
Right, because there's a time when captive narratives, like you said, are very, you know, sensationalized, very racist, very, you know, this is what the public wanted to read and this is what would sell. And some of these stories are really worth revisiting from a fresh eye. How did you sort through some of those early depictions and say, okay, there's more humanity here and it's time to weave this tale a little deeper?
Well, many of the accounts that were written in the 1800s just were really, really sensationalized. And a lot of the things that were told about, they were repeated, but just given different names, but it was the same story. So you could toss those straight out. And so what I did is I started to look at the Workman Papers in the Minnesota Historical Society, which were letters and accounts that were assembled in the 1880s, talking directly to the people who had lived and survived that settlement. And from there, I started to look at what made each woman unique and strong and look into their backgrounds and explored census records and news accounts and you name it. I explored it, but I was looking for each individual woman and their personality so that I could shape things accordingly.
What kind of questions did you bring to that research? I mean, were there things that came up again and again about, you know, who is she? What was she thinking at this time? What were her actions? Like, what were the questions that just came up again and again for you?
For example, one of the women witnessed several of her children killed in front of her. Mm-hmm. What gave her the strength to leave them and go on to live for her surviving kids, not knowing where those kids were? What gave Julia Wright the courage to stand up and be a leader of these women, and even of some of the men when the men were with them, and say, we need to do this, we need to do that, we need to do something else? And how did a strong woman like that end up with the type of husband that she had, who was somebody who took advantage of Native Americans every chance he got?
You have done, you know, reenactments and costume work from different historical periods. So you have also tried to put yourself into character. Tell me a little bit about how that informs your work as a writer as well.
Every person has unique depth, and in adapting to any role that I've had, whether it was living history or community theater or whatever, finding that grain of humanity and motivation. Motivation is what carries you completely through, and it carried people through the historical events, and that's also the key thing in writing fiction. You've got to have motivation for your character in order to build scenes.
Mm. You've also loved and lost and loved again.
I have.
Does that play into this sense of romance and love and connection between two people who care deeply about each other in your work? Does your own personal journey of losing your husband and then finding love again unexpectedly, does that influence you as a writer too? It has to.
Yeah, everything you go through, but especially the extremes, when you go through heartache or you go through pain, and then when you go through joy, those things are the driving forces in humanity. And when you can hook on to one of those and put that in, it just brings it home, because we've all experienced those things. So those are things to really draw on. Yeah, I mean, you have to really imagine how your characters are feeling. And if you've lived some of that, then the empathy comes more naturally.
Well, thank you so much for spending time with us today. I'm going to tell listeners, she's speaking about her book, Pam Novak, talking about her latest book, which is called Never Let Go. That's Thursday night at Fort Sisseton State Park, tonight at the South Dakota Cultural Heritage Center and Pier, and then on August 31st, she'll be in Sioux Falls at the Old Courthouse Museum and at Siouxland Libraries. You can find her books and more about her on her website at PamelaNovak.com. I'll spell it for you, N-O-W-A-K, Pamela Novak. Thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate that.
Thank you, Lori.
For centuries, visual artists have returned to their favorite landscapes to paint again and again and to see things anew. Now imagine you could see layers of that revisiting in one piece of art, morning, evening, each moment floating upward in layers of paint, in layers of experience. Martin Weinstein's solo exhibition, Moment to Moment, is on display. That's through November 7th at the South Dakota Art Museum in Brookings. And Martin joins us now on the phone. Martin Weinstein, welcome. Thanks so much for being here.
Hi. It's great to hear from you.
We are reaching you in New York, and your art in this exhibition has traveled all over the country and is now in Brookings, South Dakota. Tell me a little bit. Help people understand these acrylic sheets and how you paint in layers by going back again and again to the same, you know, artistic experience. How do you describe your work, especially on the radio, to people?
Well, they're largely about time and memory, and I paint, you know, I paint en plein air, you know, in front of whatever, you know, the subject is, flowers, the landscape, people. And I paint from life, but then they're painted on transparent acrylic sheet, plexiglass, and I layer them. I'll come back to the subject a day later, a year later, 3 years later, paint it again. And areas are, some areas are more transparent, some areas are more opaque, and so the information from the bottom layers comes up through. So I'll layer a morning scene over an evening scene. Some paintings, even different seasons of the year, layered over each other. And yeah, a little bit of fall will come peeking through.
Yeah. And these are displayed and mounted in a way that really accentuates the brushstroke and accentuates the passage of time. How do you handle the sort of, you know, the assemblage of this work?
Yeah, they're displayed in a plexiglass sort of box, but it has grooves, and the sheets are held slightly apart from each other.
Yeah.
But they're held at angles to each other because the plexiglass becomes a little harder to see, you know, a little more diffuse as there's more space between the layers. So each layer sort of passes from being very clear to being more faded, almost like a memory fading away.
Yeah, I was hoping you'd say more about memory. Tell me a little bit more about how that, I mean, are you, from the process standpoint, are you looking at what you painted yesterday or even a year ago before you paint the scene today? Are you thinking about memory of, you know, family and a changing landscape? Say more about memory and how it intersects with your work.
Yes, I'm painting mostly in places that I know. I'm in Hudson Valley at a house that was my parents' house. So, yes, I'm painting trees that my mother planted, and sometimes I'll paint, you know, a layer that I painted, you know, 2 years ago. I'll paint another layer on top of that, but maybe the tree has fallen down in a storm, and so, you know, part of the original image is gone, but now there's something new. It ties in also to, you know, I've done some reading about physics and the sense that a lot of physicists have that time doesn't really exist and that, you know, it's an illusion and that everything is existing at once. So somehow the way that emotionally ties into our feelings about memory and, I don't know, it has resonance for me.
Art in the multiverse. the end of time, and this sort of, you know, I love, you know, this idea of physics and thinking about not only different things existing at the same time, but how fragile and unexpected that we are even having this conversation right now with, you know, when you think about, you know, spinning forward into the future, and this is what human beings are doing right now with our time in a day that no one will remember however many years ago, but here we are making this connection. You're doing that with visual art.
Yeah, and it's particularly, I have to say, at this moment in time with the pandemic and, you know, having been sort of locked in my studio for a year, there's something about having, you know, painted for a year with sort of nobody seeing them. And, you know, it's just sort of, I think a lot of artists are feeling this. It's sort of wonderful in a strange way.
Yeah.
If people weren't getting sick, you know.
Have you been to South Dakota?
No, I haven't, and I was going to come for a talk and, you know, for the show, but, you know, everything's on hold, and we're doing the talk on Zoom instead, which is also a different thing.
Yeah, the whole thing is a trip. Well, I love, as I was looking at your work online, because I have not been up to the gallery yet, I love your florals. Just, I just, that's what resonates with me so much. And you do portrait work, too.
Yes, I do. Yes. Friends. Just friends.
Just friends.
I've been asked, do you do portraits on commission? I'm like, I wouldn't even know how to start. I need to know the people. And, you know, it's going to take a while to do layers. And, yeah.
So you feel the same way about the landscape, that you need to know the landscape? You need to know the flower? You need to know it before you can paint it?
Paint on vacation, but I have to say mostly we go back to places where we have friends, you know. So again, I'll be bringing back a layer that I painted a year ago and do another layer on top of it. And I used to, you know, do watercolors when I travel, but I no longer do because somehow painting without the layers just doesn't seem real to me in the same way.
You have found a place that the work is beautiful. I cannot wait to stick my nose a little too close to it until someone tells me not to. Shh, don't tell. Martin Weinstein, thank you so much for being here with us. We really appreciate getting to know you a little bit.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Martin's solo exhibition is called Moment to Moment, and it's on display through November 7th at the South Dakota Art Museum in Brookings. And Martin joined us from New York.